culture isn't being nice to people. It's not buying them pizza or celebrating birthdays. That's nice, but that's not culture. The military doesn't have a strong culture because a drill sergeant is buying them pizza or taking them to a baseball game.
All right, gang, welcome to this episode of the Dealer Playbook Podcast. Sitting down with my new friend, he is the author of Stop the Shift Show, Scott Greenberg. We're going to be talking all about how to turn struggling workers into powerhouse teams. And you know that applies to us in retail automotive. Here we go. The car business is rapidly changing, and modern car dealers are meeting the demand. I'm Michael Cirillo, and together we'll explore the best strategies, ideas, and tools to create a thriving life in and out of the business. This is the Dealer Playbook. Scott, thank you so much for joining me on the Dealer Playbook Podcast.
Glad to be here.
I've watched a bunch of your content. You resonate deeply with me. First and foremost, sense of humor. I always love someone that can get a room full of people to laugh. But I got to ask you, you've spoken in front of so many different crowds, Costco, IHOP, all of these big organizations, Freddy's Shake and Steak Burgers, one of my delightful places here in Texas for a nice little cheap meal. Do you find walking into those rooms with those people that they can be as straight faced as some of the rooms of car dealers that I walk into? And you feel like, man, what am I going to say to break the ice with this crowd?
Oh, yeah. You know, every single audience, you never know what you're going to get. I mean, I've given presentations to rooms full of engineers, just science minded people who like don't even know what laughter is, let alone are capable of doing it. And so, you know, my job isn't to try to get them to be more like me or laugh. It's to try to figure out who they are and meet them at that level and then see if slowly I can start to kind of warm them up, that kind of thing. But I always start off trying to connect to them. But yeah, it can be tough with some crowds.
You're like, dude, there are morgues with more energy sometimes.
That's right. But as long as they're willing to pay my fee, I'm happy to speak to them. So.
Yes. Hey, I could be talking to a wall. And
yeah. At least the cadavers don't heckle.
Let me ask you, how did you get into this? I mean, not everybody wakes up and says, hey, I want to be a speaker. I want to be an author. I want to help people with this. What was your journey into, you know, this passion you have to help organizations break a threshold and experience accelerated growth?
Sure. So I really started off wanting to be a storyteller. And so I was actually a film student at New York University. And at the end of my first semester, I was diagnosed with cancer. And had to drop out and spend a year battling that. And it was during that battle with all these other cancer patients getting chemo that I observed the different ways they were reacting to it. And that just made me really curious. Because in film school, they said, pay attention to the human condition so you can make your characters more authentic. And so I did that in these kind of very public cancer clinics and started noticing these differences and was discussing with a friend of mine who was putting on a conference. And at the end of my treatment, he said, hey, why don't you be our keynote speaker and talk about your experience and how it applied to leadership. And that one speech 30 years ago has led to this career that started off as motivational speaking about resilience and then peak performance and then leadership. And it's evolved considerably. But I found that this is a great way where I can still tell stories, but hopefully I can help people be the best versions of themselves.
This resonates so deeply with me because it's we often joke in the retail auto industry that we fall backwards. It's like a trust fall back into this industry. And once you're in it, you're in it. And there's kind of this joke that there's no leaving it. Even people that have tried to leave, they come back into it. But what you're saying resonates with me too, because you think of, well, once you realize that somebody's life has been impacted in a positive way, it connects you almost, I feel like, to a tapestry of this passion that only the Lord knows why we have. How do you feel? Does that reflect how you feel about this passion you have to help others?
Yeah, you know, we have our plans for life and life has plans for us and life generally wins, but life is often right. Like you have your one way, one path that you think is going to work for you, but often we get derailed onto a different path that can still honor your values and meet your needs and make you happy. It's just not the direction you thought you were going to go. So that's what's happened for me. That's what's happened to a lot of people. The trick is to not resist that. It's to be open to these other alternative paths and then see what the opportunities are.
Mm. I was I saw this video that I love the way they explained what you just shared, and I want to kind of dig into this a little bit. The presenter said, "Have you ever heard of the red car methodology or thought process?" And of course, I had never heard of it. And she says, "Well, how many coming here today? How many red cars did you notice driving in?" And the guy goes, "I can't think of any." She says, "What if I told you that I was going to pay you $50 for every car, red car that you could notice and tally on your drive-in? Do you think you would notice more red cars?" And he says, "Well, yeah, absolutely." And she says, "Well, the same thing applies to opportunity. The same thing applies to opportunity. We go through most of our life, as you're saying, Scott, where you know, there's life's plan and your plan. And if you're so focused on your plan, you might miss the plan that the world, the universe has for you. And it's really about understanding those opportunities for growth and acceleration already exist. It's whether or not your mind is conditioned to recognizing them." What's your take?
Yeah, you know, so I'm a bit more in the business world now than in the motivational speaker world, even though I kind of straddle both. But certainly in the motivational speaker world, you know, you get this message of you set your goal and you develop a plan and you remain laser focused, right? And we start quoting, you know, Michael Jordan and Oprah Winfrey, and it's all about drive and focus and, you know, they do exactly, you know, to make it tangible. But there's something to be said for like chilling out a little bit and kind of going with the flow and letting go of the reins a little bit. I think that it's less intense. I think it's more natural. And I think it's going to take you to some great places, because how many people are laser focused on their goal? They get there and then they're bummed out and they're disappointed. Like, that's it.
Right.
So there's kind of both sides to it. So I do think that we need to expose ourselves to opportunity. And I love the idea of like really kind of, you know, looking for things, but looking for them and being open to them in areas where maybe before you were not so open.
How do you encourage people to keep an open mind like that?
Well, it's hard because we all have our own ways of thinking, our own personalities. If you've ever taken the DISC profile, you know, there are the D's, and I am one that's, you know, they're all about, you know, getting stuff done. And those people tend to be laser focused. And so for them, it's a bit more of a stretch compared to other kinds of people. I think it's something you have to experience and have to kind of reflect on. And it's a difficult thing, but I think just bring it up and discussing and saying, you know what, it's okay if you fail. It's okay if you change. It's okay if you quit, even though the phrase, you know, never, never, never quit. And, you know, sometimes it's not quitting. Sometimes it's changing. And changing often is a way to upgrade your life. Mm. So I think we kind of need to be open at all and not be so religious about a lot of these motivational beliefs and cliches. Allow ourselves to be human, work really hard, but continuously learn and improve.
This look, you know, this makes me think of the organization of a car dealership where you have leaders who historically, traditionally impose outcomes and goals on the team with no collaboration on their part. And then you have teams who show up every day freaked out that they will not meet these goals that have been imposed upon them, that they have no clue how those goals were set to begin with. And then you have underperforming organizations as a result, where now leadership resents employee, employee resents leadership, and everybody just then shows up for their paycheck. How do you recommend breaking that cycle?
Well, you know, I'm all about data and statistics and measurement. So, you know, I don't preach, even though they call me a motivational speaker, I don't preach positivity. I think people make a lot of irresponsible decisions just based on optimism and faith and positivity. I certainly don't preach negativity. I preach clarity, like looking at the data, looking at the numbers, right? You know, some say the glass is half full, some say the glass is half empty. I say the glass has 4 ounces of water. Like, that's objective. You know, I owned retail businesses for more than 10 years, and that was the most helpful kind of thinking. So the question is, what is it that leads to high performance? Is it being people oriented? Is it being results oriented? And there's a study that was done that I wrote about in my new book. And in the study, they looked at 100,000 managers and collect data from a million of their employees. And those managers who are considered, you know, very results oriented, but not people oriented, only 9% of that group was considered to be among the top 10% of all managers. Well, then they looked at a different group, those who people, the employees that were really people and culture oriented, but not so results oriented. Only 8% of that group was considered among the top 10%. Turns out that players want to play for coaches who win. But when they looked at managers who were, who could do both, who were results oriented, but also people oriented, 82% of that group were in the top 10. Top 10% of everyone. But here's the problem is to be people oriented and results oriented requires using two sides of the brain that can't operate simultaneously. So really great leaders have to be very deliberate about going back and forth to manage all these things. But that's where we get the best results.
Hey, before we hop back into this episode of the Dealer Playbook, we got to give a shout out to today's sponsor, AutoFi. AutoFi helps progressive dealers like you sell smarter, not harder, on your dealership website and now in your showroom too. AutoFi solves the everyday problems dealers actually face, like bottlenecks at the sales desk, customer distrust, and decision overload. And their all-new showroom solution includes deal estimation, desking, lender routing, and an F&I menu, all in one powerful platform that bridges the gap between the CRM and DMS. Dealerships with AutoFi can manage the floor more efficiently, fast-track the yes, and make better lending decisions, enabling them to sell cars faster with higher satisfaction and more profit. In fact, deals with AutoFi take an average of 28 minutes from customer check-in to loan approval, and dealers are making $411 more back-end PVR per deal. Go to autofi.com/dealer playbook to learn more. That's autofi.com/dealer playbook and start selling smarter today. All right, let's hop back into this episode. I'm going to come work for you, I think, is what's going to result from this this episode. I love how you said, I preach clarity backed by more data, backed by these studies. Certainly, we're going to get more into your book in just a little bit, but it makes so much sense. It's the proverbial kind of, hey, back away for a minute so we can look at what the reality of the playing field is. Then, you know, perhaps once we get a lay of the land and we understand the playing field, then we can move on to possibility and all of those things. But until we get a good grasp on where we are today, we'll never know what the next step is to grow.
Right. And, you know, look at, since we're talking about, you know, automobiles here, it's like, what's the most important part of a car? Is it the engine or is it the body? Well, you need both to have a working car. So I feel like this debate between hard skills and soft skills is silly. It's these two things, both of which must be good, must be solid, and must be there at a high level in order to get high performance. And it's always boggled my mind as to why people gravitate so much towards hard skills and they're dismissive of soft skills. Maybe it's because hard skills are more tangible. But clearly, the data shows that those who also have the soft skills on top of the hard skills, they're the ones who are thriving. So I almost don't even know why that debate continues, but I'm right here to continue to advocate for soft skills on top of the hard skills.
So let me ask you this, in that context, when you're looking to hire new talent, are you looking more at their character and soft skills over hard skills? Are you searching for a balance? Do you even believe their resume?
I look at the resume, but I look for different things than maybe that they are trying to communicate. Now, this is really important because my experience as a retail employer is in a setting where I needed lesser skilled hourly workers compared to I'm a hospital administrator and I need more surgeons, right? So in a setting where it is primarily hourly workers, and about 58%, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere between 58%, more than half of all workers in the US are hourly workers. And I'm not talking about high skilled workers like nurses and, you know, lab techs, that kind right. of thing, but you know what I'm talking about. So in that kind of setting for that kind of worker, I'm less interested in the hard skills they bring because I can help them develop those. I'm much more interested in, you were saying, in the soft skills, right? Their ability to communicate, their ability to embrace our value system, their level of resilience, their social skills. Those things matter more to me because those are harder to teach. You can reinforce them, but I only have so much time. So, you know, I'll train you on how to do, you know, X, Y, or Z, but I want you coming in with the kind of personality, the kind of people skills that are going to enhance our culture and are going to translate to a better customer experience.
The one thing that comes to my mind as you speak about this, as I look through the chapters and the subject matter of your new book, I wonder, how does this work inside of an organization that has operated a certain way for so long, right? You talk about a crisis in management. I mean, somebody reading your book is going to go, oh, wait, I identify with what he's saying here, but how do I change? Change is so hard, like you said earlier. What are some of the common things you notice that successful organizations who operated one way can do to start operating in this new way?
I believe that the first place anyone wants to look when they want to see improvement in their organization, in their teams, whatever, the first place we have to look is the mirror. Am I an asset to my organization, the way I lead, the way I manage, the way I think? Am I an asset to the organization, or might I be a liability? Might I be hanging on to old ways of doing things? I was in another interview recently, and this journalist was saying how she talked to a chief technology officer at this organization, okay, leads this team of you know, developers and, you know, technology people, and was complaining that, you know, they're younger millennials and, you know, older, you know, Gen Zers, and starts talking about how they're different and not responding to traditional ways of doing. He's complaining. And I just thought it was so ironic that here's a guy whose entire job is about focusing on technology and innovation and staying ahead and change in that regard. But when it comes to his own management style, he wants to hang on to old technology, old ways of doing things, right? Management is a form of technology. Culture, in a way, how an organization is run with its people is a form of technology. And technology needs to be continuously updated and improved, or it becomes outdated. And so I think that if an organization or managers within an organization are really committed to being a great organization, to being an employer of choice, they need to continually ask, how does management itself, how do we have to change? How can we adapt to today's workforce so we can bring out the best in them? You know, car dealership, you know, in the car industry in general, is constantly paying attention to consumer preferences. What do consumers want? You know, is it electric? Is it sexier bodies? Is it this color paint? You know the industry better than I do, but you pay attention to what the customer wants and you adapt to it. And the industry doesn't judge customers for what their preferences are. They just adapt. But when it comes to employees, when it comes to not the market changing, but the labor market changing, that's where we get judgmental in kids these days, and we resist, and we want them to respond to our old ways of doing things. We need to adapt to changes in the labor marketplace if we want to have up-to-date management and become better organizations.
Yeah, it brings to mind, you know, this concept of, well, how often am I actually setting myself up to fail because I am constraining myself predicated upon limiting beliefs or the way that I got to where I am, and that I'm not, to your point, factoring in today's circumstances and environment and so on and so forth. I love, you know, you have a sizzle reel of your speaking on the homepage of your website, and you read a real job post for a dishwasher, like what I think we could all agree is probably where I'm going to send my 14-year-old to go and, you know, do that. And I love the way just your facial expression, the way you deliver it. And of course, the audience reaction, making it seem like you need to have enjoyed a career of 30 years washing dishes or else they're not going to be willing to hire you. And you just pose the question like, and it made me think, are we just not setting ourselves up to fail in the millennial and Gen Z dialogue that all of us aging people want to believe they're all lazy and this and that? Like, how often are we actually setting ourselves up to fail?
Yeah, well, continuously, right? And it's a tradition of failure that goes back, you know, since the beginning of employment, right? Every generation says kids these days. Every employer says, wow, these young workers, they're lazy, they're entitled, that, you know, forgetting right. that people said that about them. You know,
yeah, we all turn into our parents, Scott. That's what's happening.
Right? Right? And so, I should be so lucky to be my parents and have such an awesome son. No, I do have an awesome son, but my son is different. My son is different than I am. But when I stop judging and I look at who he is and how he is and his influences and his peer group, when I stop judging, well, then I can see more clearly and figure out, okay, what drives this group? What's important to them? What offends them? What inspires them? And part I have to remember is, first of all, that they're not just different, but they're also young. You know, our brains continue to develop until 25. So we think they lack common sense. Well, they might lack full brain development. That's part of it. But every generation changes. And our job as management isn't to try to get them to be more like us. Our job is to adapt so we can sell to that generation, so we can market to that generation, but also so that we can manage them. And in my book, I have found a ton of employers who manage hourly workers in a variety of industries: hospitality, retail, restaurants, franchises, manufacturing, sales environments. And they're a minority, but I have found enough work environments that have cracked the code for managing younger hourly workers. They've proven that it's possible, as it's always been possible, to get great performance. But all the people who are managing them, who I write about in the book, part of what they do is they change and adapt just like they do for their customers. That's how they get the most out of their employees.
I mean, just such a fitting topic. You probably can't see it too well on camera here, but I'm wearing a shirt that says "More Than Cars." Part of it, a mission that I'm on with some buddies of mine, is that we ought to love people more than we love cars, where historically the narrative in our industry is, no, it's about moving metal. How much metal can you move out into the... And we're seeing a shift. There are more and more leaders and managers and individuals in the retail auto industry who are like, no, wait a minute. It's about people. If we can empower people, then the byproduct, the healthy byproduct, is we move more metal. We bring in more customers. We retain customers. Lifetime value of customer goes up. And the value, the lifetime value we as the business can give the customer also increases, some of which you've touched on: better service, adapting to customers' needs, et cetera, et cetera. When you say hourly workers, to me, I immediately think of mindset. Whether you're salary, whether you work at a dealership, whether you're in retail in some other form, you work at a restaurant, whatever, there are those who show up with an hourly worker mindset. And there are those that, regardless of however they get paid, whatever the monetary structure is, they say, I'm showing up to lead myself and to treat this like either the stepping stone that it is or the learning ground that it is. But ultimately, my ambition is such that I'm going to use this and I'm going to use it as rocket fuel to grow. What's your take?
I absolutely agree. What I would add to it is that there's not only a mindset, but there's also a perspective for management. That management often sees hourly workers differently than they see salary workers. Right. So often with salary workers, they see, well, this is part of our family. They're going to grow with us. There's opportunities for them to go deeper within the organization. But then that same organization will look at their frontline employees or hourly workers, and it's a bit more transactional. They're a bit more faceless. You know, they're lesser paid. They're lesser skilled. They're not getting the same benefits. And the employees feel this, which is why they're less loyal. Whereas someone on salary has, you know, hours they can predict. Benefits, you know, they know how much money they're going to make next month. You know, they can build a life around that. Where hourly workers, their hours can be reduced, their hours can be changed. And there are a higher chance that an hourly worker is going to another job or going to school, or that they have other people in the family who are working jobs. They have to revolve around them. They're very, very different, but they're seen very different by management, and they're not treated necessarily with as much love and with as much respect. And I understand that with hourly workers, you're lesser skilled, your labor dollars can only go so far. And as an organization, you may not be able to pay your hourly workers as well as, you know, some of the white collar people on salary, but you can create a work experience for them. You can meet their, what I call their soft needs, their emotional needs, on top of what you pay them. And that will make you a best in class employer for the hourly worker. It's more likely to keep them when they're having a good experience where they're getting compensated emotionally in addition to financially. They're less likely to go down the street to make another dollar per hour. So part of it isn't just their own mindset, but the mindset of management and how they choose to manage these workers.
Yeah, that makes sense. I remember years ago, I read a study about how leadership, and this was pertaining to culture and creating happy workplace culture, showing that there is a direct correlation of happiness and employee output, and that it's the leader's responsibility. It's not the leader's responsibility to make people happy. It's their responsibility to create an environment with which happiness can exist.
Right.
And that the multiples on it. And to your point, now all of a sudden we're seeing employees who, despite knowing they could make an extra dollar or two down the road, are choosing to stay here because it is serving more of the needs they wake up with a longing for than just money. And sometimes I feel like we think it's always just about money. Just throw more money at it.
We saw that at the end of the pandemic, when everybody was short staffed and was desperate to get employees. You know, most businesses didn't up their game in terms of the work environment, in terms of communicating that work environment that help wanted ads. They just threw more money at it. They offered higher starting salaries and signing bonuses. But then even if they could get the employees, they couldn't keep them because work still sucked, because culture was still toxic. Because, you know what I mean? Those who were able to recruit and retain, some of them got people in the beginning by offering more money, but they kept them by offering them a better experience. You know, certainly in retail, we know that when someone has a really good emotional experience of buying the car, they don't just love the car, but they love the acquisition. They love the process. They really connected with the salesperson and all that. Well, they're more likely to come back. They're more likely to tell their friends. The same is true with your staffing, you know, in recruiting employees. That if employees are having a better emotional experience that also feels better, they're also going to tell their friends, and then we're also more likely to remain loyal. But yeah, money alone just isn't going to do it. And which is good news, because again, we need to keep our margins. We need to, you know, maintain you know, our labor costs. But there's no reason why we can't provide a better experience. And when we do, we're going to save time because we're not constantly recruiting. We're not constantly managing problems. We're just maintaining culture.
Boy, oh boy, we could do a whole other podcast just on the topic of culture. On that note, as we wind down here, my question for you as it pertains to culture is, as a leader, what can I do to assess the current state of my culture? How do I know? Is it toxic? Is it not toxic? Is it in the middle? Is it okay? What do you recommend? What should I be looking for?
Okay, remember, I'm not about glass half full, glass half empty. I'm about measuring the amount of ounces of water. Yes. I believe that culture shouldn't just be discussed and built and maintained. It needs to be measured. It needs to be measured so it can be managed. So you literally create metrics and you have conversations, formal and informal, and you conduct surveys and you quantify it. You know, we talk about net promoter score, which is often used to measure customer service. You can measure employee net promoter score by asking that same single question. You know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely are you to recommend this job to a friend? That's one measurement. You know, would you characterize management? It's not hard to find questions on the internet for surveys to measure culture. You know, I feel that my teammates have my back. You know, agree or disagree, or, you know, that you can come up with these questions and measure it and figure out what that is. Sit down with employees and say, hey, do you know what our mission is? What are our values? Right. And then come up with ways and specific behaviors that reflect those values. Values alone mean nothing. I tell my clients, for every value you have, come up with a list of behaviors, do's and don'ts that reflect the value. You can tell someone, hey, make sure that you demonstrate integrity. What does that even mean? Instead, teach your employees, we always follow through in our commitments. We always say the truth. We never talk about each other behind each other's back. You give them a list of behaviors to which they can be held accountable. It's easier to teach that than just to teach the overall concept of integrity. So we make it tangible, and then we measure it, and then we look for ways to improve it, and then we measure it again, repeat. That's how we assess it, and that's how we make sure that we're improving it. And understand that culture isn't being nice to people. It's not buying them pizza or celebrating birthdays. That's nice, but that's not culture. The military doesn't have a strong culture because a drill sergeant is buying them pizza or taking them to a baseball game, right? So you have to be much more deliberate about understanding that culture is the way people communicate and interact. We want to be very deliberate about creating a belief system and a behavior system that reflects the culture you want to have.
Fantastic. I love this conversation. Scott, thank you so much. How can those listening or watching get their hands on a copy of your book, Stop the Shift Show?
I'm so glad you asked. So it comes out February 13th, but it's available now wherever books are sold for pre-sale. So you can go on Amazon and just search for Stop the Shift Show, and it's available now. And you can get more information on that and on me on my website, which is www.scottgreenberg.com.
Love it. Scott Greenberg, thanks so much for joining me on the Dealer Playbook Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Dealer Playbook Podcast. If you enjoyed tuning in, please subscribe, share, and hit that like button. You can also join us and the DPB community on social media. Check back next week for a new Dealer Playbook episode. Thanks so much for joining.